KCBR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Partygoers told to shelter in place when an unusual late summer storm hit the desert northeast of Reno, Nevada, are now leaving Burning Man. CBS's Elise Preston with the latest.
We're getting out of here.
Today finally was moving day, but it was a slow slog. Tens of thousands attending the event that celebrates being off the grid have been stuck in gridlock. There is just one road to leave the isolated Black Rock Desert.
We just spent 4 hours in line to get out. And the people in line now, getting in line now, might spend 12 hours.
President Biden traveled to Philadelphia today to speak to at the Tri-State Labor Day Parade. More from CBS's Nancy Cordes.
This is a president who likes to say that he is the most pro-union, the most pro-labor president ever. And so Labor Day is a day that he likes to celebrate. He likes to get out a crowd and mix it up. And today when he spoke in Philadelphia to sheet metal worker union members, it was no different. He touted his record on the economy. He talked a lot about union projects.
Republican presidential candidates Mike Pence and Vivek Ramaswamy have been making Labor Day campaign stops in New Hampshire and trading barbs. About half of the U.S. faced temperatures above 90 degrees today, with record heat in some portions of the country expected to continue for the next several days. CBS's Meg Oliver reports.
As extreme heat continues to roast New York, fans and players at the U.S. Open Tennis Championships in Flushing are trying to cope.
It's doable when you have a fan.
Today hit 90, about 10 degrees higher than normal. Ahead of the first day of school tomorrow, the Philadelphia Public School District announced early dismissals through Wednesday for students who attend schools with little or no air conditioning.
Governor Ron DeSantis says all public schools in Florida will be open by Thursday, just about 1 week after Hurricane Idalia pummeled portions of the northern Gulf Coast. DeSantis and hard-hit Perry says
every school district, including those five counties, will be open on Thursday. So that's pretty significant when you have an almost Category 4 storm hit, especially hit a part of the state that hasn't necessarily had these storms hit on this path.
Law enforcement is still trying to catch a convicted killer who escaped from a Pennsylvania prison last week. Lieutenant Colonel George Bivens with the Pennsylvania State Police says there have been 4 sightings of Danilo Cavalcante and urged residents in the area and the search area to take precautions.
I know it's stressful for the community, but I want to assure you that all of us are working diligently to bring this to a conclusion.
This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Wisconsin wildlife officials are looking for whoever shot and killed 3 trumpeter swans and a great blue heron in northeast Wisconsin last week. The rare birds are protected species. Wardens say it happened in the Navarino Wildlife Area near Clintonville. The sentence for killing a protected species in Wisconsin is up to 9 months in jail, $5,000 in fines, and a 3-year ban from hunting. The latest heat wave is breaking single-day records in parts of Wisconsin. Madison reached a high of 93 yesterday. That beats the previous record of 92 set in 1960. In Milwaukee, unofficial highs yesterday climbed to 95, which is technically tied with a record set in 1939. The National Weather Service says Madison would beat a 100-year-old record today if the mercury climbs to 94. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Ready to ride?
Just let me get my flip-flops on.
Whoa, Mom and Dad are going for a ride without their protective gear.
Quick, grab the checklist. I'll grab the gear.
Just where do you two think you're going without your safety gear?
Yeah, you know how we feel about riding without your gear.
Well, it's so nice out.
And we're only going for a short ride.
Not before you put all this gear on, you're not.
But...
riding pants?
Okay.
Check.
Motorcycle boots?
Bye-bye, flip-flops.
Check.
Armored jackets?
Nice.
Check.
Riding gloves?
Two pairs.
Check.
Last but not least, full-face helmets.
Check.
Now you're ready to ride.
And you look cool.
All the gear, all the time. Zero in Wisconsin. Together, we can save lives. Learn more at zeroinwisconsin.gov.
Be home on time for dinner.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
When you think about early labor unions, do you think of Wisconsin? You should. The state's first labor union formed in Milwaukee in 1847 when the bricklayers organized, then the carpenters union in 1848. The national labor union didn't even form until 1866. A state historical society report shows Wisconsin's union members also pushed for workers' compensation and unemployment insurance legislation, becoming a model for other states. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
See by 2024.
I know, so we're going to have to buy new chargers to meet those standards.
And finally, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced that her state is following California's lead in phasing out polluting internal combustion engine cars. New York will ban the sale of new gasoline and diesel cars by 2035, although auto industry analysts see some signs that the inflection point for electric cars versus gas cars may come much, much sooner.
Very cool. And thank you for copying us, New York. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. We come to you from Baker's Bar and Lounge in Hamtramck, Michigan, on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. Going to talk about some conversations with workers about, well, decent wages, decent hours, decent conditions. Our friends at One Fair Wage have put together an incredible event here at Baker's Bar and Lounge. We're going to talk to some work people to find out what here in Michigan they're doing to ensure that, well, there's one wage, one fair wage. We do away with this tipped sub-minimum wage nonsense. We pay people a decent living wage, and we move work forward. And this is one of those things that we've been talking about here on the program for quite some time. How do you make people's lives better? How do you make better lives for working people? How do you do that? Well, you do that by people coming together. And that's exactly what the folks here in Hamtramck are doing today as we spend the next couple of hours talking about the trials, the tribulations, how difficult it is to get by on a sub-minimum wage and on minimum wage as a whole. Understand, if minimum wage had kept up with productivity, minimum wage would be like 20, 23, 24 bucks an hour. Had it kept up with CEO pay, well, let's not even begin to talk about how insane that would be. Because what's happened in this country is we have not shared in the wealth that our labor has created. And we see this time and time again as we've gone on this tour. And it was never really, to this point, never more stark than what we saw in Scranton. The children in mines, you know, crawling around in muck and filth and desperation to create massive amounts of wealth for the handfuls, while communities suffered, struggled, and, well, starved. The reality is we are seeing inequality grow at rates never seen before in our lifetime. And this is a moment. This is a moment for us. It's a moment for us to step forward, stand up, speak out, and say, you know what, maybe we can do better. Now, look, I'm thrilled to see what's coming out of the White House. I'm thrilled to see the kind of organizing that's going on in the streets. And this goes hand in hand. Look, we've got an administration right now that's listening to working people. We've got an administration right now that's concerned about working people. That hasn't happened in a very long time, which is why you're seeing all of the moneyed interests throwing into these outlandish attacks against the administration. Right now, there's an opportunity. There is an opportunity to move in a direction to rebuild, revitalize, re-energize a prosperous working class, to make work pay again, to create wealth in the hands of the working people who spend the money. This is the mastery of what my grandparents' generation built. A generation of working people who had wealth, disposable income that they could then go into the economy and spend, and entrepreneurs, you know, made products and services that people wanted, and it was this snowball forward. We haven't seen that in a while. What we've done is we've built, sadly, what is the wealthiest economy in the world on the backs of, well, desperate labor, easy credit, and exploitable markets. And I was watching this clip the other day of Warren Buffett saying, look, you know, we won. We're winning. My class is winning. Enormously winning. Yeah, you know, we've seen our wealth go from some $90 billion of the Fortune 400 in 1982, you know, $2.5 trillion. You've seen this explosion of accumulation of wealth at the very tippity top. And we've talked about this, how, you know, the bottom half of the country has seen actually a negative gain in wealth, while the top 1% is just off the charts. And for me, it starts with this kind of grassroots organizing. It starts with people coming together. It starts with people speaking out and saying, you know what, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're no longer going to take it. And we're seeing it. I mean, you know, I was just reading another story. There's organizing at Home Depot. There's organizing at REI. There's organizing in so many different places. Amazon, Starbucks, you name it, there are people who are finally saying, you know what? We want better. We want more. We want opportunity. We want a chance for the future. So for today on the program, that's what we're going to be spending a little time talking about here at Baker's Bar and Lounge in Hamtramck, Michigan, here on the Working Class Radio Tour. We want to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, and I want to throw a shout-out and a thanks to our friends at American Family Voices, also Courier Newsroom, for throwing us some support and helping us get out on the road and talking to people and sharing stories and, well, you know, coming up with how do we move forward? How do we do what we want to do? We'll take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the best of The Rick Smith Show. We're taking a break during the holiday season, wishing you and yours the very best holiday ever. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. At 2:02 in the afternoon, President Woodrow Wilson at the White House touched off an explosion at the Gamboa Dike in Panama. With that touch of a button, the last barrier to joining the waters of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans through the Panama Canal went up in smoke. The Chicago Tribune described the scene in Panama, writing, quote, "Then suddenly came the muffled roar of the discharge of 1,600 pounds of dynamite, which sent a shower of water, mud, and rock high into the air. Spreading out as it went upward, the whole heavily veiled into a cloud of smoke. As water began to pour through the rent made by the explosion, the crowd sent up a great cheer. It was a noteworthy moment in the construction of the canal. But that moment came at a staggering cost of workers' lives. For more than 20 years, the French and then the United States worked on the canal project. The U.S. phase lasted for a decade. As many as 45,000 workers toiled on the canal during the peak years of construction. These workers came from the United States, Europe, Asia, and Panama. West Indians formed the core of the work crews. These workers faced stifling heat, brutal working conditions, and poor accommodations. Workers had to contend with ravaging disease, poisonous snakes, and torrential rains. Workers also faced racial discrimination. For example, West Indian workers earned half the hourly wages of U.S. and European workers. They also lived in much more crowded barracks. Worker deaths were so frequent that death or funerary trains made continual runs to bring the bodies away from the construction site. It is estimated that more than 27,000 men died building the canal. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged. On the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. Some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived." For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. This is the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Baker's Bar here in Hamtramck, Michigan, as we continue our Working Class Heroes radio tour. Today we're talking with low-wage workers about, fighting for dignity, fighting for respect, one fair wage. Our friends at One Fair Wage put together a great event of low-wage workers coming out here to the bar, spend a little time of community, a little time coming together, but also talking about a very important issue, and that is dignity, respect, and all of that on the job, making a living wage and making jobs that are available, good family-sustaining wage jobs. And I'm sitting here with my executive producer and Working Class Hero Radio Tour co-host, Brett Pransky, the professor. Brett, how are we doing today?
We're doing great. Having a great time here.
So what do you think of this bar? I mean, I got to tell you, I love these old-time bars. Reminds me of being a kid again.
Yeah, I mean it's a great old place. It looks like we should be shooting a movie here. You know what I mean? It looks like a perfect old time movie scene.
Yeah, I mean, and getting here was interesting as well, because you hear about these towns and you hear all of these rumors, you hear all this stuff, and what a beautiful little place. I mean, I wish we had more time to spend, going through all of the shops and all the the bakery down the block.
Yeah, I mean, I really wish we could. I mean, just with, with what's going on and how many different places we go and how quickly we have to get there, we're, you know, the downside of that is we don't get to spend the time that we would like to in some of these destinations, you know, to explore, to really get to know the neighborhood. It seems like, you know, too quickly we have to pack up our gear and move on to the next destination.
And pack up the gear. That was a fun kind of bit. And look, we've been traveling several days now. We're traveling in this giant RV. So you kind of get this picture. You know, we roll up in these inner city settings in this giant RV, and there's literally nowhere to park. We're down in the parking lot way at the, you know, like a mile away. We've got to lug our gear down the road. But the interesting thing is you're bumping into people in this area, Hamtramck, very diverse. In fact, we were talking to one of the people in the bar who had grown up here and has spent his entire life here. He said, look, you know, this used to be, you know, the kind of place you didn't walk around with a bunch of expensive gear. And now it's a thriving area. It's coming back. He was saying back, you know, when he was younger, the rent here was like $200 a month. It was, he used the S-hole word. Now, you know, it's a very diverse community. The storefronts are full. You know, there are people coming back. There's activity. And again, I come back to, you know, it's the movement that we're coming back to. It's the investments in communities like this that I think are helping.
Yeah, I really think that's the case. I mean, the gentleman that you're speaking of was born in Ukraine, came over as a very small child, spent his entire life here, and saw the neighborhood transition and saw, you know, different populations come and go, and saw some of the old storefronts go away and new storefronts coming in. And, you know, there's been some real improvements here over time.
Now, the interesting thing to me, and this is where we're kind of in this weird moment, we spent a little time talking to people, talking to some low-wage workers, that fear, and this is, you know, this is another one of those moments of the moment in time that we live in, the lack of power of workers and the lack of power that they feel. We couldn't get anyone to come on air and say, hey, this is what it is. But the stories we heard, heartbreaking.
Yeah, some of them really were. And, you know, there were people out there. Now, some were just kind of camera shy. You know, they had never done any media before and weren't really looking to get their start at it today. But there were people out there whose sole reason for not wanting to come on the air and tell their story was the fact they didn't think they should or didn't think they could, or that there was just simply too much to risk.
Now, again, I go back to, you know, one of the stories that we got. You know, this person was, you know, managing bars and restaurants before the pandemic. And again, the stories coming out of the pandemic is how poorly people are treating each other. And I guess that's going to be a theme as we travel across our tour, finding that, you know, maybe we're just not talking to each other well anymore.
Yeah, honestly, I think that is going to be a theme. I think it's something that we're going to see from place to place as we travel around. I mean, keep in mind, there was a very short time ago, these were the essential workers. That was a term that we heard, you know, in every broadcast everywhere, was these are essential workers, and without them, none of us would get by. And, you know, everything was gonna go to pieces if it wasn't for these essential workers doing heroic things to keep us going. And now that things are it's not that the pandemic's over, but things have calmed down. We found ways to, you know, to live with the conditions and so on. And we've gone right back to kind of the same levels, if not greater levels of disrespect, you know, for these folks that we showed before the pandemic. And that's just, you know, that's just sad.
Now again, you know, you come back, as you said, you know, coming out of this pandemic, there's kind of an awakening, that moment of saying, you know, you are essential, you are patriotic frontline heroes. You kind of get a sense that these folks, you know, they bought it. They believed it. They wore that badge of honor, and they don't want to give it back.
Yeah, and also one thing that we saw, you know, especially coming out of the pandemic, was that, you know, this treatment, especially when things reverted back to how they were before, a lot of these folks just decided they weren't going to take it anymore. And they decided to move into different fields and, you know, and do different kinds of work. You know, and lots of times there were opportunities to do this because of, you know, some of the job creation, the massive job creation, you know, kind of as the pandemic has been winding down.
Now, I look at this and I keep coming back to the fact that our wage structure, the fact that workers have, especially at the lower end of the economy, such little power, such little ability to fight. And in fact, later on, we're going to talk with Representative Andy Levin about wage theft, because it's got to be one of the things that I bring up, because, you know, unions, you know, as someone who's been a union member my whole life, that's where I fight wage theft. If an employer were to cheat me, that's where I would go. Sadly, you know, most working people don't have that luxury. I'm hoping they get it. May want to make sure that happens. But what we know, and the studies are, you know, they're out there, that, you know, wage theft is one of the biggest crimes in this country. You know, you can add up all of the bank robberies, all the gas station stick-ups, all of the, hey, give me your money kind of robberies, and it would be like 10 times less of what wage theft is. And I know that's shocking, but you listen to some of the stories of the people that we've talked to, it's rampant.
Yeah, it really is. And a lot of it comes from, you know, some pretty basic understandings of the rules and the laws, and not necessarily the laws, but how they're enforced. There's a number of rules and laws out there that are supposed to rein in this type of behavior. But most of the time, what you'll find if you look into them is, even though a rule or a law or something may exist, the enforcement mechanism for it does not. So, you know, an employer may be able to, may do something, you know, improper, but the worker may not have the means to hold them accountable for it. So even when the law is there, we don't necessarily have a way to enforce it.
You know, I remember the first time I found out that wage theft existed, and I know, a little naive. It's when I met my wife. She was giving tours. At the time I was volunteering as a Big Brother, and we went on with Big Brothers Big Sisters. We went on this tour ride. And, you know, she was there, and, you know, we were talking, and we kind of hit it off, and we were, you know, having a good time, and, you know, all that. And at the end of the tour, they handed everyone envelopes and said, hey, if you enjoyed the tour, you know, give your tour guide a tip, and, you know, it's, you know, all this stuff. And of course, you know, being the male of the time, what do you think I did?
You probably left a pretty substantial tip, I'm guessing.
I did, equal to what the entire tour cost. And it wasn't until my wife and I were married about 10 years that I asked, I go, you know, did, you know, what, you know, something? You remember that? And she's like, no, I never got it. And that's when she told me that the tips at that place were all collected by the company, you know, held and pooled, they said, so that the full-time workers, not the volunteers like she was, they were given the luxury of a 1 week's vacation. You start doing the math of the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who go through there, and people, dumb people like me, who leave, you know, good sized tips, and how much those workers were being cheated, because I put that money in that envelope, that tip in that envelope, specifically for the person that did the work that I was, well, trying to, you know, eventually marry, but because they did a good job, and only to find out that it didn't get to them infuriated me.
Yeah, as it should. And when you think about it from her perspective, let's say that tip was stolen from her, which it obviously was, and she discovers that and she wants to do something about it. What exactly can she do? I mean, I'm sure she can quit and go work somewhere else, but that's not going to solve the problem. And that's not going to alleviate the theft. So again, kind of like what I was saying earlier, the means of enforcement in many cases are not there. So even if you are wronged, and if you know you were wronged and you want to do something about it, the means to do so in many cases just don't exist, or they're really hard to access.
And this is why it's so, you know, again, you come back to, why do elections matter? This is why attorneys generals matter. This is why having an attorney general who's going to fight for workers, like in our state, Josh Shapiro has done an incredible job. And here in Michigan, Dana Nessel, who we're going to have on the program tomorrow, you know, has done a fantastic job on this front as well.
Yeah, they really have. I mean, again, I think if I remember right, I think Josh Shapiro took a case. It was the largest wage theft case in Pennsylvania's history. I believe it was just a few years ago while he was AG, and he was able to recover tens of millions of dollars for workers. I can't remember the name of the company that he took to court, but he was able to recover amounts in the tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, and again, I come back to this, and because it's an interesting juxtaposition. We had a president a couple of years ago who, the person that he put in charge of protecting workers from wage theft, it was actually someone accused of wage theft. We now have an administration that is going after people, you know, actively going after people who cheat workers. So an interesting kind of juxtaposition, if you will.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, and I say this everywhere you go, you get what you vote for. You know what I mean? When we vote for people who are going to rob us blind, we cannot be surprised when they turn around and rob us blind. And when we vote for people who say they're going to hold these folks accountable, then we get to expect them to do what they said they would do and hold these folks accountable. So really, you know, at the end of the day, we get what we vote for. We get what we go to the polls and demand.
Yeah, I mean, it's but I go back to that moment and the anger, even today, and it's been 20 years. I'm still ticked off that she got cheated out of this. Now, she understood what the game was, not that they were getting cheated, but that she wasn't entitled to that. So she wasn't upset. She was a volunteer. She just loved horses. It was all that. But what if that was her job? What if that's how she raised her children? She supported her family, supported herself, to have an employer be able to do that. And that's why I have some problems and some questions about, you know, what we're doing with low-wage workers, especially the people who service our meals. On this tour, we've had some fabulous meals and some people who do wonderful work. I want to make sure that the tip that I give them actually gets into their pocket.
Yeah, and for example, you were talking about the case, you know, with your wife when you first met. That company solicited a tip in her name, which is what really makes it terrible. You know, they knew that she was never going to receive it, but they used her and her work to solicit a little extra money more than the cost of what they were charging people already. Yep. There's the real dishonesty in it.
The absolute dishonesty. Going to take a quick break back here from Baker's Bar in Hamtramck, Pennsylvania. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day acclaimed photojournalist Dorothea Lange died. She is celebrated for her work documenting the Great Depression for the Farm Security Bureau. Lange's photos captured images of migrant workers, sharecroppers, and the rural poor. Her iconic photo, Migrant Mother, is probably her most well-known image. It depicts a despondent Dust Bowl mother surrounded by her hungry children. Lange was born in Hoboken, New Jersey in 1895. She suffered the effects of polio as a child, which left her with a permanent limp. She studied photography at Columbia University in New York and eventually settled in the Bay Area. When the Great Depression hit, she began photographing labor strikes, bread lines in soup kitchens, the homeless, and unemployed. The Resettlement Administration hired her soon after. Nowadays, we can access images from around the world at a moment's notice that broaden our understanding of current events. But until the 1930s, few Americans could access media that adequately depicted the desperate social conditions engulfing the nation. Federal programs that funded projects like Lange's brought Depression-era images into the public eye. Americans soon realized their suffering wasn't caused by personal failure, that millions across the country were experiencing destitution brought on by broader economic forces. During World War II, Lange worked for the War Relocation Authority, where she documented forced evacuation and internment of Japanese Americans. Her images, especially of Manzanar, were withheld from the public until after the war and were accessible to the public through the National Archives. After the war, she taught at San Francisco's Art Institute and co-founded the magazine Aperture. She has been heralded as an innovator and has influenced generations of documentary photography. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Last year's gubernatorial race in Virginia was narrowly won by Republican Glenn Youngkin. An elite Wall Street multimillionaire, he was going to lose until he discovered a right-wing racist bugaboo called critical race theory. Glenn suddenly turned into an anti-CRT attack dog, fomenting parental fear and promising to sweep all teaching of the theory out of Virginia's classrooms. But golly, CRT was not actually being taught in any of the state's public schools. To help Youngkin dodge this inconvenient fact, a partisan front group called Metric Media created 25 fake news sites in Virginia that ran nearly 5,000 articles during the election, spreading the CRT bugaboo. While these papers have no subscribers and no significant readership, they allowed demagogues like Youngkin to use such lies in speeches, ads, etc., laundering them as facts by simply saying, as reported in the such-and-such newspaper. With success in Virginia, Metric Media and other fake sites are pumping out CRT sludge in Florida, Texas, and other states with gubernatorial races this year. Indeed, the lie has become its own political industry, with such billionaire extremists as the Koch brothers pumping money into it. This is why America must have actual local newspapers, widely available and affordable either in print or online, that have the community commitment and journalistic resources to do the job of nurturing truth and democracy. Otherwise, we're ceding news to the shams and scams that are inevitable under hedge fund profiteers and networks of partisan hacks that already dominate wide swaths of America's media landscape. This is Jim Hightower saying, journalism is key to democratic self-government, and we should start investing in it, providing public funding for local independent watchdog reporting.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Baker's Bar and Lounge here in Hamtramck. I got to tell you, I love that name. It's a fun name to say, Hamtramck. It's such a fun name, such a fun city name to say. Welcome back here to our Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. We're in Hamtramck, Michigan. Yes, I am in Michigan. It's hard to believe that I have found my way here. As a kid growing up in Cleveland, still got that. It's kind of like finding me in Pittsburgh. It's one of those things. It's kind of weird, but I am here because I'm here for a good reason. We're going to fight for better wages, hours, conditions for working people, make lives better. This is what it's about. And I'm here talking with Roland Leggett. He is the Midwest campaign manager for the good folks at One Fair Wage, their website, onefairwage.org. Roland, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for coming. I didn't know you were from Cleveland, though. I would have had second thoughts about chatting with you. I'm just kidding. Welcome to Michigan, Rick.
It's an experience. But here's the thing, and this is the great part. You know, we were in Erie yesterday. I grew up in Cleveland. You know, I've been to places all across the country. It doesn't really matter where you're. It all looks kind of the same. You know, where working people are, it seems all kind of the same.
Yes, and
it has the same kind of flavor.
It has the same kind of flavor. We love good food, and we're hardworking. And I have to say, a lot of people that have – I encourage people to explore the Midwest. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the country in certain places, too.
So let's get into this. I mean, and thank you for inviting us here to this bar for this event to talk about something I think is really important and making sure that people earn a decent wage. I can't think of anything more that I'd rather talk about, because when we do that, we make lives better. And when we do that, we make communities better. And I think we make the country better, maybe pull us back together and end some of the partisanship that we see. And I understand Michigan is trying to do that by ending the sub-minimum wage. For folks who don't know what the sub-minimum wage is, you want to walk me through some of this?
Sure. So the sub-minimum wage is that wage that folks that are often in the food service industry are paid, so it's below the minimum wage because the expectation, quote unquote, is that they make up that wage in tips. So, you know, in certain parts of the country, the sub-minimum wage can be as little as $3 or $4 an hour. With fingers crossed, a worker can make up that over the course of their shift. Here in Michigan, it's just over $9 an hour, but it's still nowhere near a living wage, a wage in which we can ensure that folks can take care of their families and of their needs.
Yeah, I read something that, you know, the federal minimum wage, the tipped minimum wage is like $2.13 an hour or
yes.
Something ridiculous like that. Hasn't been raised since the 90s?
Yes, that's correct. And it's really, it affects the most vulnerable among us, right? So there's a misconception that a lot of folks in the tipped wage industry are, you know, teenagers or something, or don't have families to support. And that's just simply not true. And what ends up happening is that so many workers around the country end up having to work multiple jobs in order to make ends meet. It's incredibly difficult to do everything from parent to be a caregiver for a loved one or a family member. And frankly, it's difficult just to take care of your own basic needs when you're working three and four jobs. So it's just so important that folks get the wages that they deserve. And we're really excited here in Michigan because we have an opportunity to give Michigan workers that raise that they've worked so hard for.
So walk me through what's going on here in Michigan. What is it that they've done? What is it that you're doing? And what's the path forward?
Sure. So what's happened is that in 2018, we worked alongside a number of coalition members to get past legislation that would raise the wage for Michigan workers. The legislature back then, with a few dirty tricks on one side of the aisle, made it much more difficult for that raise to move forward. We're fortunate, though, here that we're able to not only ensure that that raise does happen. We have a different governor in Governor Whitmer who's supportive of this. But also we have an opportunity moving forward to have conversations with workers all over the state around how we can maintain the political power that they've created and make sure that they get the results in terms of their wages that they deserve.
No, it's that political power that mm-hmm. I think that's what people are afraid of. You know, because you hear people talking about, well, we can't raise the minimum wage because the price of a hamburger will be $3,000, and you go, now you're being kind of ludicrous because you look at other countries who seem to have figured this out.
Yeah.
Who seem to have, you know, given their low wage workers some bit of dignity and respect, because we used to believe that, didn't we? I mean, at some point.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Yes. Well, listen, you know, you're in Michigan. We're in the shadow of Detroit right now, where we built the middle class. And so we were able to prove here first that you can have an equitable and safe workspace where folks can make a living wage. And, you know, Rick, you don't have to look outside of this country to see examples of this working well, and that it lifts, you know, there's a saying that a rising tide lifts all boats. There are states all over the country in which there isn't a sub-minimum wage.
Like which states?
So California is one of them.
Well, California, you know, the prices of things are just completely outrageous, I'm told.
Well, that's true, but it's not because of workers in the food service industry or tip wage workers. There's a number of other things that that affect that. But that, you know, there are states all over the country, as I said, where you're seeing higher wages for workers than you see at the federal level, and you just don't see the economic impact, the doom and gloom that so many folks have said in the past. And you know, one of the things that I've noticed quite a bit in this work is in talking to small business owners, and in particular restaurant owners, they talk a lot about the inability that they have to hire workers to staff shifts throughout the week.
We've been finding it. Look, we on this trip, we've been eating out an awful lot, mm-hmm. and you go into places, you know, they're understaffed.
Yeah.
They're having a problem finding people because, you know, one, jobs are plentiful. There are places for people to work. But two, I got to tell you, I wouldn't want to work in the service industry, given the fact coming out of the pandemic, we're miserable to each other.
Yeah.
And for $2.13 an hour, there's no way I'm putting up with somebody's nonsense.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the things to remember, too, is so, of course, we're seeing a lot of folks, that have left the industry as a result of the stresses of having to not only do the job, but also, you know, mitigate a community health risk with the pandemic. But, you know, I've also found that restaurant owners and small business owners are not a monolith. So there are plenty out there that are progressive, that pay their workers what they, a wage that they deserve, a living wage. And
here's where I got to stop here. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I guess it's one of my pet peeves.
Yeah.
The word deserve doesn't belong there. It's one of my pet peeves. They earn this.
Absolutely.
You earn this.
Absolutely.
The wealth that's being created in these establishments is done because of the people who actually do the work. And this is where I think working people really have to stand up and puff their chest up a little bit and say, I did this. I built this. I made this profitable. And I should be sharing in it. I demand I share in it.
Yeah.
I guess this is just a pet peeve of mine, and it just sends me into a rage.
I appreciate it, and I happily stand corrected, Rick.
I don't mean to correct you, but it's just that I hear that so often. We deserve this. No, you don't deserve it. You earned it. It should be your right to it. And I guess it's semantics on a certain level.
No, it's a value statement, and it really reflects what I was saying about, you know, there's so many progressive, for example, restaurant owners that respect that their workers have earned this, that they work very hard, that they not only have earned a living wage, but in many that also have earned the right to health care and to paid time off. So it's really a value statement, Rick. So I agree with you.
Wow. Can you say that again so my wife hears it? Hey, could you say that I'm right again?
Yes, and I'll even write it down.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Roland Leggett. Roland's the Midwest campaign manager for the good folks over at One Fair Wage. OneFairWage.org is their website if you want to check out the work that they do. Highly suggested and doing fantastic stuff, not just here in Michigan, but across the country. And you guys have had some pretty significant wins. I guess in Maine, you're doing some work right now on the ground to move this forward as well, right?
Yeah, and we're doing work in Maine, the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., rather, and you know, a number of other states. We have a big push planned in Ohio for later this month and into November. So we're working all over the country. And the idea is to bring a living wage to tip wage workers all over the country, and we're going state by state. And it's a movement that's built by the workers in the industry. So we're not, you know, kind of swooping in and getting this work done. It's led by folks on the ground in these states that are focused on this issue.
And the idea of, you know, building that worker power, and this is something I talk about quite often because I've been very fortunate in my work life that I've always had a union. I've always had a union card in my wallet. I've always had that kind of empowerment that I've had a voice in the workplace. And if I wanted something done, you know, it was going to get done. I think every worker should have that sense of empowerment. And this is moving in that direction, I believe.
Absolutely. And the way we're doing this, as I was saying, because we're utilizing the talents of workers in this industry, is that it's a movement built by the folks that are most affected by what we're talking about here. It's built by the folks that are doing everything from bussing the tables to cooking the food, all, you know, every aspect of these industries. And so it makes it that much more impactful, and there's so much more ownership in so many of the canvassers and volunteers that we have with this, because they're the ones we're fighting for each other.
Yeah. So let me ask you the other side of this, because I know I've got some conservative friends whose heads are exploding at the fact that we want, you know, someone who is bussing tables or washing dishes or serving or cooking or doing any of the things that the people that you represent, their heads exploding. Well, these aren't jobs that are worth $15 an hour. I don't even make $15 an hour. So what's the response to that these aren't skilled jobs that are worthy of that kind of income?
Well, I would say that, as you said earlier, this isn't about, I don't think it's even about a skilled set. It's about workers working hard and earning a fair living wage. And, you know, I certainly do not think it's up to me to decide what a skilled worker or role is or isn't. But I do know that a worker that is doing all that they can to do their job well certainly has earned a wage that would allow them to live a life to reflect that. And so that's really what this is about. And that's why I said earlier that, you know, that I was happily corrected, because it's a value statement. It's about values. And I'm someone, and I know that the rest of the folks at One Fair Wage are as well, folks that believe that if you've earned something, that's something that you have, that you should get, and that includes a living wage.
And it should be demanded and fought for, absolutely, without question. But again, we're sold this message, Roland, aren't we? That, you know, some work is valued more than others. Some people are valued more than others based on what they do. And I've always been a believer, and I don't care what it is you do, work should be rewarded. Work should be valued. And there's dignity in all work, no matter what it is you do. Because, well, that's how people support themselves. And we used to believe that. I think back to my grandparents' generation, it didn't matter if you were a truck driver or a doctor or a lawyer. All work had value.
Yeah, I do think that. But I also think that there are more people that agree with that today than you might think. And I see examples of that all over the state of Michigan and in the states we're working in around the country, that people value work. And when they hear about how difficult it is to get to work in so many of these roles, they understand how important it is that folks get what they've earned. And I'm also, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm a firm believer that we have more in common than we have that separates us. And as a country, as a people, there are so many things we were told were impossible, from the moon landing to a black president. You know, you pick your, you know, there's a number of things to pick through history that we have accomplished that wasn't even, that was supposed to not be possible. And given our proud history of being able to do things we were told impossible, I know that making sure that tip wage workers earn a living wage all over this country is something that is 100% possible.
I can't do any better than that. That's a perfect place to end this. Roland, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff, my friend. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks for having me, Rick, and thank you for coming to Michigan.
Thank you so much, Roland Leggett, Midwest campaign manager here with the good folks at One Fair Wage. Make sure you check out their website, onefairwage.org. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. 50,000 people gathered in the small town of Mount Olive in southern Illinois. They had come to commemorate a new memorial to renowned labor leader Mother Jones and to honor mine workers who had lost their lives. 5 special trains and 25 Greyhound buses helped to bring the crowd to the Union Miners Cemetery. The cemetery was founded as a resting place for fallen miners. In 1898, in the town of Verdun, violence erupted. Remembered as the Verdun Massacre, 7 miners were shot dead at the hands of company-hired guns. 4 of the murdered miners were from Mount Olive. The miners were originally laid to rest at the town's burial plot, but the owners of the cemetery objected to the ceremonies that the union held there. So, the local miners' union purchased land and moved 3 of their brothers to the new union cemetery. When Mother Jones died at the age of 100 in 1930, she asked to be buried with her boys at the cemetery. The miners raised more than $16,000 for a monument. The 22-foot-tall obelisk is made of 80 tons of pink Minnesota granite. On the obelisk is a medallion bearing the likeness of Mother Jones. She is guarded on either side by a larger-than-life bronze statue of a coal miner with his sledge. In 2015, a crowd of 300 gathered for a rededication of the monument. Illinois AFL-CIO and the United Mine Workers of America spearheaded the campaign to raise $100,000 to restore the site. One of those who attended the rededication was Bill Felica, a local retired miner. He told a reporter, "Mother Jones is like a local hero. She wasn't afraid to stand up to the big shots like judges and politicians. She was just a hellraiser." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Spent a little time here at Baker's Bar in Hamtramck, Michigan, enjoying our time with our friends at One Fair Wage. Spending a little time with tipped workers, hearing the stories that they share and the lives that they lead. Sadly, the amazing part of this is, and I don't know how folks, a lot of these folks, I don't know how they make it. When you hear the fact that the minimum wage, the tipped minimum wage on the federal level is like $2.13 an hour, hasn't been raised since the 1990s, you go, I think there's a problem. Houston, I think we have a problem. And I'm sitting here with the producer, the professor, my working class heroes, tour mate, my friend Brett Pransky. Brett, how we doing?
We're doing good. We're doing good. It's a great place. I'm real happy to be here.
So, you know, in talking about the fact that there is a sub-minimum wage, you know, it's bad enough that 7.25 is the minimum wage. I still have no idea how anyone exists on that. But to drop that down and go, well, you know what, 213 is probably going to be enough. And, oh, by the way, if the employer is going to be good enough, nice enough to raise that up to the 725 to make up the difference, that's how the law is kind of written, knowing, and I think we know that some employers, well, cheat, lie, steal, thieves, not great, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They do it all the time. And when you think about the subminimum wage and, you know, just the existence of it in the first place is really criminal when you look at it. And you have to think to yourself, now, how did this originate? At what point did we decide that the minimum wage was too good for some workers, so we need to lower it? And when you consider it, you know, at the time that these wages came into place, a lot of these roles are filled, you know, or at least have been historically by women. Now it's a little more, you know, it's a little more even now, but these were career fields, you know, in the past that were almost exclusively filled by women. And sometimes you think that the wage probably existed not because, you know, anyone was doing any math, but simply they were looking at who was doing the jobs and then trying to decide what they thought those folks deserved.
Now, I go back to some of the responses I've gotten over the years, because we've talked about this on the program, you know, thousands of times over the years, and how ridiculous it is to have this split wage, because I'm against the idea of two-tier wage structures as a whole. But I come back to it, and I struggle with a society that, you know, is going to take care of us, is going to clean up after us, is going to feed us, is, you know, people we called heroes, essential, all that stuff. And then we expect them to get by on poverty, desperation wages. And this is one of the moments, and one of the things we talked about with Roland is, you know, workers understanding their power and coming together and organizing in a way that will increase that power. Now, I don't know that you're ever going to get back to the days where you have waitress and waiter unions. I don't know that that's going to happen. So lobbying as they're doing to increase, you know, the laws and using the legal system to make their situation better, like we see in California with the Fast Recovery Act, where across the industry they're raising standards, maybe that's the way forward.
Yeah, I really think it is, because what's really interesting about what they're doing in California is the results. Some of the counter arguments to raising the subminimum wage is people think that prices are going to go up, or and what we're finding is when we do eliminate these subminimum wages, prices don't increase, or at least they don't increase substantially. All the doom and gloom and kind of those kinds of stories that people use to kind of say that we shouldn't do this, they turn out not to be true when these things are actually implemented.
Now, what's interesting to me is, you know, over the years, I've talked to, you know, wait staff and people who this is their career, and I've asked them about this. Do you favor, you know, closing the subminimum wage and going to a wage system? And what's interesting to me is how many people come back, no, we can't do that. We can't possibly do that because X, Y, and Z. You know, they'll get rid of the job, or, you know, they'll cut my, you know, they'll cut the number of people doing this. All kinds of negative stuff. And with some of the people we talked to, you know, some of the organizers, they were explaining that this is the other NRA's handiwork at play, not the gun people, right? The National Restaurant Association, who is equally as powerful, just a little more quiet. Their lobbying efforts are paid for, actually, and I didn't know this, are paid for by the workers, because to work in a restaurant, you have to get this Safe Serve certification that says you know how to work with food, you understand, you know, all of the important things, that the hygiene, the OSHA stuff that you need to know to work around food and to keep people safe. But to pay for this, the money that goes to paying for that certification, the NRA is using, the other NRA is using to lobby to keep the wages low. So it's this kind of scenario where the workers are actually paying to screw themselves over.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, paying ATM fees to access your own money. I mean, it's
exactly,
you know, things like, I mean, it's the craziest thing. So we're actually charging the workers and then using their money to work against their interests, and using that money to feed this system of lies that says, oh, your job's going to go away, or, oh, people won't tip anymore if the wages are raised. And you know, it's just not true. And it's absolutely criminal that we're stealing wages to fund all this nonsense.
No, it's the fear that they really, you know, because look, these people are struggling to get by as is. And I remember this. I was at a Pizza Hut and the waitress, I was talking to her, and she said, you know, she was against it because they've already told her that if this happens, that if the $2.13 minimum wage is raised up to what they're supposed to be mandating, to the 7.25 number, that her job would be eliminated. I'm going, really? And you buy that? And she did, because she was fearful that she was going to lose this situation.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you know, just a quick note to business owners out there, if these wages were to change and you can't pay them, or you don't think you can pay them, the problem isn't the wages, and the problem certainly isn't the workers. The problem's your business model.
Yep. No, you probably shouldn't be in business. And I've heard that, you know, time. Oh, I just can't compete. Well, maybe, I don't know, take up cutting grass.
Or do something else. Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, because we need these people to make living wages. I mean, I understand desperation is a powerful tool. And that we've used desperation for years and years and years to keep.
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.